and I call it mental fluidity. Even though it's good to have your project and be clear about it, you want to be able to recognize change and adapt to it in an appropriate way. And I'll be damned if I can quantify what appropriate means in this case. But you want people to be knowledge sponges. For example, I get people all the time saying, I want to, you know, would you mentor me? And they talk about their product and that sort of thing. And I start asking them questions about, you know, who's your competitors and who else is doing something like this? And a lot of times they'll say, well, nobody and that sort of thing. And I pop onto the internet and do a search word around their things, and all of a sudden there's 40 competitors. And I say, you know, this they haven't done their homework. You know, goodbye. I don't need you. You really have to be the world expert on the business that you're creating.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Nolan, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure. Good fun to be here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd like to say that you're a man who needs no introduction, but amazingly enough, there was somebody who said, who's Nolan Bushnell? I said, well, he's the guy who founded Atari and hired Steve Jobs. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about your story, your journey, your background, and everything that has led you up to where you're at in the world today?
I think if I go back to what I consider the breakpoints or the singularities in my existence. It was Mrs. Cook's third grade class in which I was allowed to play with the magic science box that was in the closet. And she assigned me to explain to the class, which she did with various things, you know, with, you know, one week it was optics, another one it was, you know, plants, another one it was basically, she'd use the students as a way to sort of teach the other kids. And I was assigned the unit on electricity. And there were dry cells and lights and switches and electromagnets. And I put the things together, read the study plan, and was smitten. And I went home from school that day and set up a card table in the corner of my bedroom and started tinkering and basically never stopped. I mean, I got every battery, every light, old flashlight, and I realized that you could actually put wires to a flashlight and to a flashlight bulb and a battery, and you didn't need the flashlight housing at all. And that was magical to me. That led me to a ham radio license and, setting up transmitters and receivers and talking to people all over the world. And I had a neighbor who was a ham radio guy, and he was sort of my early mentor. And that led me to entrepreneurship because the radios were expensive, the parts were expensive, and you could not divide your lawn mowing money and allowance into those transmitters and without saying, gee, I'm going to be 35 before I get those. Mm-hmm. So what I discovered is that I knew enough electronics, that this is at the age of 10, that I started my own TV repair business. And in those days, TVs were all based on vacuum tubes. And when a TV went out, it was because the vacuum tube had gotten gassy or just worn out. And fundamentally, what you'd have to do is take the back off, figure out which tube had gone bad, replace it, and the TV would work again. So in those days, a house call was $5. I charged 50 cents or a dollar. But I made money by marking up the tubes a lot. So I got some inventory, figured out where to buy tubes wholesale, and created a business. And that bought my transmitters and receivers and what have you. But it really gave me this whole idea that don't work for somebody else, work for yourself. Figure out how to do it, because that was in the days where minimum wage was 50 cents or 75 cents an hour. I just thought that wasn't very cool. I could make a lot more than that by doing my other things. Probably fast forward to college, where I was pursuing an engineering degree. And I can say that at 10 years old, I decided I wanted to be an electrical engineer. And I was pursuing that. And sort of as a way to put myself through college, I started a little company called the Campus Company, which was a, which took a big piece of paper, you know, heavy stock. And I created the Campus Blotter, which was the center was a calendar of events for the quarter. I sold advertising all around it and gave it away free at the beginning of the quarter. And, that became extremely lucrative in one university, and then I ended up doing it to the four universities that were in the Utah area at the time. I was born and raised in just outside of Salt Lake City, and you know, the University of Utah, BYU, Utah State, and Weber State all had the blessings of getting a campus blotter. The economics were real simple. I could get them printed up for about $500. I'd sell $3,000 to $5,000 worth of advertising and pocket the difference, and that was more than enough to keep me in style. I drove a 190 SL Mercedes, which was really cool, as well as putting myself through college. So life was good. But I got so good at selling the advertising that I could do it literally part-time during the summers, because many of the advertisers would re-up quarter after quarter. And so I decided to get myself out of harm's way, and I got a job on the midway at the local amusement park. Now, it was a minimum wage job, but I was not doing it there to make money. I was doing it to keep me from spending money, because I knew if I was working, I wouldn't be out, you know, running around having fun spending money. Well, it turned out that I got good at it, and I really got a real passion for games, and I was promoted to be manager of the whole games department the third year that I was there. The third summer. And that put under my auspices an arcade, which gave me a really strong understanding of the cost of arcade machines, how much they had to earn, what have you. Then, I guess to triangulate that, I was in the electrical engineering department, and part of that department was a professor called Dr. Evans, whose center of gravity, if it was connecting big displays up to the big computers. And in the middle 60s, when I was in college, a guy at MIT had created a game called Space War on the PDP series, and that software basically became viral. It was, you know, this was before the internet. And so somebody was shipping naturally a deck of cards cards to the computer centers. But we all played Space Wars in the middle of the night. And so that was a triangulation, which I said, gee, if I could take this game, put a quarter slot on it, and take it into one of my arcades summer, the thing would make a lot of money. But you divide 25 cents into a million-dollar computer, and the math didn't work. So, you know, this was when computers were in an air-conditioned room with an elevated floor and, you know, looked like a, you know, big long row of refrigerators. So I guess that experience, then I graduated, went to work for Ampex, which was also in the video business. And I learned more about video technology, met Ted Dabney, who was my partner, who I asked to become a partner in doing the first video game. And that was, well, when I say the first video game, it was a raster scan technology. And that's kind of the pathway.
That leads you to Atari.
Correct.
So let me ask you this. You know, I want to take a few steps back to the very beginning of this. You know, I love that you brought up this idea of singularities in your existence, which to me, I look at sort of as molding moments in our lives. And, you know, one of the things I, you know, look back at in my own life is how many of those I missed and how often I've seen adults who miss those. And I'm really curious how you sort of reconnect with that. If somehow you missed it in your childhood, because I don't think everybody finds it at age 10.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it was really an interesting thing that if there was one thing that I'm blessed with, and I have no idea how I got it, is I'm really curious. You know, I just really I'm thirsty to understand how things work, what makes things work, what, you know, and I mean, my parents had a World Book Encyclopedia, and I can remember reading the encyclopedia, sitting down, and I'd say, well, I guess this is a day for Jay, and read all the, you know, and I wouldn't read all of them in detail, but I really wanted to understand what was the knowledge of man, whether it be history or science or biology or literature. My mother used to force us kids in summers to, or when we weren't in school, and we'd be out playing and we'd have to come in for lunch, and then she'd read for an hour to us and we could choose the book. And I can remember being very fascinated by sort of science fiction at a very, very young age. And I don't know if that was causal, but it really worked for me.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting you bring up curiosity, because I always say curiosity has led to billions of dollars in value created just because people were curious about, you know, how something would work. And I always say, you know, the real drive behind this show and doing this for me has always been genuine curiosity.
Yeah, I think that curiosity matched with passion for life. You know, there are a lot of people who get up and kind of don't meet the day with fascination about what's going to be new this day, what's going to be really great. And if you can match that curiosity with passion and enthusiasm, you know, the world is your oyster, and even more so now.
Mm-hmm.
I recently wrote a book, Finding the Next Steve Jobs, which has been extremely successful, surprisingly successful, about coming from a guy, I might add, just as a footnote, I almost flunked freshman English. I can't spell. And the thought of me writing a book was hilarious. But I did it and had a ghostwriter. And, you know, while I can't construct good English sentences, I can tell good stories. And so my collaboration with Gene Stone was great, and we ended up with a good product. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I think that right now, if you're curious and passionate, school is unnecessary. And we're finding more and more that the true movers and shakers in society are not formally educated. And I was just doing a little research for a speech I'm doing, because one of the things I'm saying is the credentials are becoming less important. And I'm wondering whether or not schools really need to fundamentally reinvent themselves on the way knowledge is transferred in this world of knowledge at your fingertips, and perhaps focus more on how do you keep students passionate and curious as opposed to dogmatically lecturing. Mm-hmm. Just some idle thoughts here.
Well, you hit one of my personal hot buttons, because I jokingly say that I'm a failed byproduct of the education system. And I've told this story very briefly. You know, my sister and I had very identical upbringings. She ended up in, you know, Yale as an anesthesiology resident, and I, you know, didn't survive at all in the corporate world, despite, you know, following a very similar educational path. And I think that education right now is a one-size-fits-all solution. And I really actually want to dig deeper into this part of the conversation. It's interesting, because I think that one of the things that has happened is that we have been indoctrinated into conformity to some degree because of the fact that education has existed the way it has for so long. And I'm really curious, you know, one, what your thoughts are on how we build a better future for preparing the young people of the world today to be productive members of society and transfer knowledge in the way that we need to. And where you see all of this going, I mean, are universities going to be out of business?
You know, there's a couple of functions of education, and probably the most used function of education is warehousing. And there is, in the world of two breadwinners, what do you do with the kids during the day? You warehouse them in the school. and I'm using purposefully, you know, strong language, but a lot of that's it. The other thing about college, in many cases, is extended adolescence, where kids aren't quite ready to grow up and take on the responsibilities of an adult life. Colleges, particularly a lot of colleges, are starting to take on the aspects of being a really nice spa or club. Mm-hmm. Great athletic facilities and a lot of fun things that can go on. And then hanging out without parental supervision, hey, it's all good. But that's not necessarily a good use of money, particularly if it's being funded by student debt. I like to talk about the reinvention of indentured servitude. Whereas, you know, in the 1700s, you could indenture yourself for passage to the New World, but you had to work it off for, you know, sometimes a 3 to 5 year indenture. Today, and of course, you sold yourself into indenture for future opportunities. Well, the same thing's going on right now in college. You're selling yourself into indenture by taking on this debt that has to be paid back, can't be expunged by bankruptcy, for a better future. And the question becomes one, is that a good trade-off? Mm-hmm. It's definitely not a good trade-off in certain, I mean, they've done all kinds of studies. It's a horrible trade-off in certain things. Like if you go into student debt to become a bureaucrat or a civil servant, or to become a paleontologist, or medieval French literature, you know, these things are not able to give you gainful employment, the economic benefit. Now, the social and psychological benefit of becoming a rounder, more fluent person in medieval French literature, I don't know. I mean, I think that's a hobby. It's not an occupation. Anyway, but those are some of the things. So maybe the right answer is to focus on young kids across the board start out enthusiastic and with passion, unless they've had really damaged childhoods. And I mean, if you go into a kindergarten class, everybody's happy, everybody's doing stuff, and it's pretty good. That gets trained out of you. That enthusiasm goes away in a lot of schools. And that is, I think, the worst truncation to train out creativity, train out enthusiasm. Because a lot of school is really boring and really a lot of drudgery. And to have to sit and endure it is not good for the spirit or the psyche.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're hitting so many hot buttons for me. You know, I think about the student debt piece because, you know, you said, French literature. I got an MBA and I got student debt from that. And I thought about sort of, you know, what are my options? I said, you know, fine, if I go and get a job at the end of my life, what I'll accomplish is having paid off that debt. And that's it. Like I look at friends and I'm like, so basically what you're telling me is you're going to spend the rest of your life, and at the end of it, your final accomplishment will be that you have your main contribution to society will be that you have paid off that debt. And it's, you know, like you said, I mean, we can't get out of it through bankruptcy, but I question if that, you know, if that becomes our purpose in life, are we robbing ourselves and the world of what we could actually offer them?
No question about it, particularly since there's so many good opportunities to get whatever education you really want. And there's what I call a credential gap right now. That a lot of times people are going to school to get a credential, not focusing on how much they actually know. And a lot of the inspired companies today are focusing on what people know, not their credentials. Mm-hmm. Like, Google doesn't even care whether you've gone to college or not. They take a look at your code or your accomplishments, and that's all they care about. And Apple to a large extent as well. And these are companies that are really kicking it out of the park right now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting because I interviewed for Google a while back and I've heard they basically rehauled their entire hiring process. Because I remember sitting thinking, okay, I'm never going to get hired in here. Like with, you know, the brain teasers they threw at me, I was like, okay, this was a disaster.
Yeah, sometimes the interviewing process can be a little bit stilted, but at the same time, by not focusing on credentials, I think, is a great step in the right direction.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think that really, nowadays, I mean, we have such an opportunity to create a body of work. Like I look at, I wondered, you know, having chosen what I have, at one point I questioned whether I'd be able to ever get a job again, but then I realized I don't have a resume. I have a substantial body of work and projects that are far more useful than a piece of paper with a bunch of bullet points on it.
Absolutely. That's so true. And I've actually thought that there might be an interesting business called testforyourcredential.com and just let people come in, do a bunch of tests, and issue a credential. And, you know, it, and people can say, well, you know, it, how do you assure that people are not phoning it up? And I think that there's a lot of things that can be done to make that credential for the self-taught, for the homeschooled, for what have you, valuable. Mm-hmm.
So let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit. You know, one of the things that I think is interesting, you brought up two things. One is early mentors in your life. And I'm really curious how we learn to recognize when these types of people show up in our lives. Because, you know, any person that I've talked to who seems to have achieved something of great significance, there's always somebody behind them or somebody who kind of gave them a push in the right direction or really was a guide in that process. And I'm really curious, you know, how do you recognize those people and make sure that you don't let them go?
You know, when I look back on my mentors, I'm not sure that I was aware I was being mentored at the time. It was a thing where they were instrumental in shaping me, and you know, and I can name them, but it's a retrospective kind of naming. Like, I had no idea that Steve Jobs considered me to be one of his mentors. I just thought we used to like to hang out and talk. And then, of course, he worked for me for a while. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until the Isaacson book, which was based on a whole bunch of interviews with Steve before his death, that he named me as one of his significant mentors. And totally unaware on my part.
You know, one of the sort of patterns I keep seeing throughout your story in the beginning part of this is this very keen awareness for recognizing opportunity.
Yeah.
And let me ask you something. Is that something that can be cultivated, or is that something you're born with? And if it can be cultivated, how do we cultivate it?
Boy. I think... I've always felt that a significant part of what has been a benefit to me is I love science fiction. And I think I've always got one foot in this world of a possible future and seeing disconnects where that possible future is the probable future is possible today. And nobody's designed it. The other thing is, because of my curiosity, I kind of know a little bit about a whole bunch of different things. And I draw connections sometimes. And I've been able to spot things that need to be done. Like right now, I've probably got 15 business plans that are marinating in my shelf of businesses that I would like to have the time to work on. But I early on found out that if I worked on too many things, they all fail.
Yeah, I would agree with that. That's something I learned the hard way.
The nice thing about having a bunch of business plans marinating is that I'm willing to share them with people and say, hey, you go and work on this. We'll start a company. I'll mentor you on it, and we'll share the profits. And all of a sudden, if I can let go, it works in a good way.
Mm-hmm. So... you know, I think this will make a perfect setup to talk a bit about, you know, the book. But, you know, you mentioned mentoring people. I mean, when you look at people that you want to work with, that you want to, you know, help out, that you want to guide to their own process of success, I mean, what do you look for in people? I mean, do you recognize certain traits in them that you can see that there is a future in this person, that they've got sort of, you know, whatever it is that will enable, you know, make them successful?
Yeah, two or three things. probably the number one is enthusiasm. There are people in life that are alive, and there are people in life that are just taking up space. And the people who are really driven, you can tell about it. They're passionate about life and what their project is, and they have a lot of real passion. The second is they have to have a certain level of self-confidence, because entrepreneurship's hard. You know, you have a lot of people telling you you can't do it. And without that self-confidence, you can be dissuaded, and grit, if you would, or perseverance is an absolute critical part of success, because you got to punch through the adversity times, the adverse times will happen. Mm-hmm. And so I look for those kind of two things. I call it grit and enthusiasm. There's another thing that is really hard to quantify, and it's I call it mental fluidity. Even though it's good to have your project and be clear about it, you want to be able to recognize change and adapt to it in the appropriate way. And I'll be damned if I can quantify what appropriate means in this case. But you want people to be knowledge sponges. For example, I get people all the time saying, I want to, you know, would you mentor me? And they talk about their product and that sort of thing. And I start asking them questions about, you know, who's your competitors and who else is doing something like this? And they're a lot of times they'll say, well, nobody and that sort of thing. And I pop onto the internet and do a search word around their things, and all of a sudden there's 40 competitors. And I say, you know, this they haven't done their homework. You know, goodbye. I don't need you. You really have to be the world expert on the business that you're creating.
I love that. So you brought up adversity, and I want to do some digging into this. Can you tell us any of the really challenging times in your life? And you know, another question that I always have around this, and this sort of crucible moment seems to be a pretty common theme for every single person I've interviewed, and it also becomes the biggest catalyst for their change and their growth. So two questions. One is, you know, stories or experiences from your life that really challenged you and kind of pushed you to your edges. And, you know, do you think that there's something that differentiates people who come out of that having grown versus letting it destroy them?
Absolutely. I think that a difficult time for me that I think helped form me a great deal was my dad died when I was 15, and I worked with him summers, and we were good friends, and I learned an awful lot from him, but he died. And all of a sudden, my expected trajectory was really called into question. And I think that there's no question that he would have helped me in college, but I had two younger sisters, and though there was some life insurance and things like that, I felt that at that point in time, at 15 years old, that I could not take money from my parents anymore, that I had to be self-sufficient, with the exception of living at home for high school. But all of a sudden, my expectations of being independent versus dependent drastically shifted. And so that's kind of one set of adversity in which, you know, it changed my attitude and I think a lot for the better. I think the other big adversity situation was one summer at Atari, the company almost went bankrupt. the video game business was not considered a business that anybody wanted to invest in. I know that sounds really strange, but one of the problems of being first with anything is people say, oh, you know, you're not making steel or shipping wheat. You know, what's, you know, why are games a business? Even though we were, you know, we were doing, you know, $20, $30 million a year in sales. But, you know, Atari started with $250 of capital. And so the hardest part of Atari was figuring out how to grow the company without investments. And you know, that was always a struggle. And we did it by, we were building machines, coin-operated games at the time, with and we get 30 to 60 day terms on the parts. We'd turn the parts into a game in 2 or 3 days, ship them for cash, and that ran the company in positive cash flow. Works wonderfully until you make a mistake and you get a whole bunch of games that you can't sell for cash. And that happened one summer when we designed in a part that failed, and all of a sudden we had a factory floor full of games that could not be finished. And we just basically had no cash. And it was, you know, people have said, you know, what did you do? I said, well, we just hunkered down and punched through it and finally got the games working and were able to start shipping. But for a 3 or 4 month period in the summer, we had lawsuits against us for non-payment of bills, that we got a default judgment. They'd send a sheriff to attach assets. We'd make sure there was no money left in the checking account. So they, you know, that's all they really want to do, is they want to attach your bank account. And at one time we had, I think, 7 different bank accounts, so that the money would be always in a bank account that they didn't have the number on. You know, we just worked through it. And people have asked me, they said, Nolan, what, you know, my company's going out of business. Should I go declare bankruptcy? And I said, well, I don't know. Tell me, how many payrolls have you missed? And he said, well, none. And I said, well, how many lawsuits have you, how many default judgments do you have? And they said, well, none. I said, oh, you got 3 or 4 months, guy. You know, give me a break.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's something internally built into somebody like you that allows you to navigate the emotional uncertainty of something like that?
Absolutely. I decided as a young man that I was an existentialist, that I really, in my gut, view life as an adventure. And it allows you to kind of externalize yourself a little bit. So when things are even really shitty, you can say, boy, that's shitty, but it's interesting. You know, and by able to kind of suck yourself out, and I've always, and I can remember my dad always telling me, you know, an undefined fear of the unknown is fearful, but in most cases you can quantify what would happen if the worst happens. And so I do that. I always say, okay, what happens if Atari fails? Does my life stop? No. Do I lose my house? No. Do I lose my car? No. Is my family intact? Yes. Those are the important things, you know? And most things in business, that's just kind of rounding error on your life.
I love that. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit, and let's talk about something I know probably a million people have asked you, and I'm hoping to ask in a bit of a different way. I mean, you know, you wrote the book, Finding the Next Steve Jobs, which really That was what got my attention. I read the book and absolutely loved it. For those of you guys listening, highly recommend it. We'll link it up in the show notes. So I have quite a few questions around this. I mean, when you met somebody like Steve, could you see then what he would ultimately become?
Absolutely not. I knew he was going to be extraordinary. I can't say that I felt that he was going to run one of the biggest companies in the world. But I saw him as a passionate, powerful person. I mean, I like to joke and say that I turned down a third of Apple Computer for $50,000.
Right, I've heard.
Which was really a mistake. But it was a thing where I thought that Steve was very rough around the edges to be a major entrepreneur. And I think when he started Apple, was he 22 or 23? You know, very, very young. And I always thought I was on the young end of things, and I was 29, I think, when I started Atari. But it's hard to say, you know, what the trajectory is. I think that I'd have to leave it with saying that I felt that Steve was extraordinary.
Okay.
Without saying that I didn't have any inkling that he was going to be as powerful and important as he was.
So, you know, you talk about finding the next Steve Jobs, which I think is you know, really a fascinating idea. You know, and I look at people like Elon Musk. I mean, my business partner, I've talked about it. Do you think that that's something that is cultivated, or do you think that's something that we're born with?
I have really no idea on that. You know, like I say, I can't really put a finger on what it is that I do that is unique. You know, it's kind of like the fish is the last person or the last object to discover water. You know, it's kind of who you are. That would argue that an awful lot of it is maybe genetic. But at the same time, I recognize a lot of things that my parents did that were extraordinary at the time. I mean, my parents let me do a lot of stuff that was kind of dangerous. I mean, and we had a house that had a whole bunch of stuff, you know, a wood pile that I could grab boards and build stuff with, and, you know, the backyard that they'd let me dig a deep hole and turn into a hut until the spiders took it over, things like that. You know, that was or when I was doing ham radio, how many parents would you allow their sons to put a red and white striped antenna pole on the roof of their house with a red light on top of it? I mean, it's not very fashionable, I can tell you that.
So, you know, I mean, the fundamental premise of this book to me is, you know, finding the next Steve Jobs. I mean, how are we going to find the next Steve Jobs, in your opinion? I mean, are there, do you see potential in people right now? I mean, do you see places where that's going to come from, industries where that's going to come from, or any trends that might indicate where it's going to happen or how it's going to happen?
Well, understand that what the dot, dot, dot is that I believe that there are thousands of Steve Jobs out there, and that what makes Steve unique is he was creative and had a vision, but he also had a vehicle, particularly later on, in which he could make that vision a reality. I think there's a lot of people that are equivalently talented to Steve that are working for companies in which their creativity is stifled or their work product is on the cutting room floor. And the one of the main messages that I wanted to give is just say yes more to corporations. If they are looking for the next Steve Jobs, don't look any further than your own business processes. and open them up and try things. Be, you know, because there are people in your organization right now that would love to do some revolutionary projects that are currently being cut down by layers of bureaucracy and management.
You know, I love this idea that you brought up of, you know, creativity, a vehicle, and a vision. And I'm wondering how, you know, one, we tap into our own creativity to develop our vehicle and connect it to our vision, which I realize is a very complicated question.
Well, it's actually, it talks about the book I'm working on right now, which is, the working title is Micro-Entrepreneurship. And I assert that what is important is to really right-size your first businesses and start early and, you know, be entrepreneurial early and often is kind of the buzzword, because there are a lot of kids out of college right now that are, that say they want to be an entrepreneur, but their mind hasn't right-sized. They want to do the next Facebook, or they want to create the next Apple computer. But it's like wanting to be in the major leagues with never ever playing sandlot ball. And I think that everybody would be better off if they just found a way to have a side business. You know, don't hire yourself yet. You know, stay working. Work on it nights and weekends, because if you're not willing to work nights and weekends, don't be an entrepreneur anyway. You know, and start planting seeds, seeing how things work. How can you grow that? And can you get it to the point where all of a sudden you can hire yourself, and then hire other people, and then move forward? And a lot of times these businesses that look tiny from the outset actually grow to be massive. And so right-sizing your business, I think, is something that people need to think more about, particularly on their initial. And the rule is, if you have to raise money from friends and family, that's too big. You know, you have a blocker. Start a business that you can fund out of your back pocket as your first space. After a while, then you save money that you've done that. And if you can't put in half your own money to your friends and family, you know, not enough. And that's sort of your next stage. And about three or four more stages, then you're ready to maybe do angel investing and try for something that could be bigger.
You know, I love that, because, you know, as I listen to you tell this story, I think about, you know, our own journey of building what, you know, people know today as Unmistakable Creative. I mean, 5 years ago, I plugged a microphone into a laptop and started recording interviews on a blog. And now we've published books, we've produced events, we're basically evolving into forming a full-blown media company. But
exactly,
we got here after 5 years.
Yeah, which is an eye blink in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I guess it is. So Nolan, I want to ask you one other thing about wealth and wealth creation and kind of how you view money in the world. Because, you know, money is such an emotional hot button for so many of us. And I'm really curious, you know, being where you're at, you know, with the success that you've had as an entrepreneur and in your life, I mean, how do you view money? And what are your views on wealth?
You know, I've actually tried to understand happiness and the correlation of, you know, what makes people happy. And it's pretty clear that once you get above subsistence poverty, everybody's pretty much equally happy, independent of how much wealth you have. So money really doesn't buy happiness. You can buy a lot of things that are fun, but that it doesn't really affect your inner happiness. I think that money is an enabler. it kind of determines how big of a poker game you can play in. And so the nice thing about having a certain amount of wealth is that it gives you discretion to be able to do other things. The wonderful thing about the United States is that we really have a entrepreneurial ethic that we make a lot of money and then we give it away. There are very few what I'd call real dynasties in the United States. You could look at maybe the Waltons, but they give a lot of money away. Gates giving a lot away. Carnegie gave a lot away. Ford Foundation gave a lot away. I mean, it's one of these things where I think the neat thing about capitalism is that it makes decisions about capital, puts it in the hands of people who have shown they're able to use capital well. For example, a lot of European countries try to determine who the entrepreneurial class is and fund them with never any good success, because the people who are making decisions are bureaucrats. They don't have any idea about what capital is and how it's deployed. And a lot of people don't understand that it almost doesn't matter who owns the capital. It's how it's deployed. For example, you want to be able to get foreign investment. That means that foreigners own the capital. Why do you want that investment? Because the capital builds buildings, you know, funds factories, does all kinds of wonderful things. But the fact that it's owned by another country is not a big deal. Same thing with individuals. You know, rich individuals, they're not going out and eating $1 billion worth of steak every night, you know. And, you know, it's really they're directing investments into areas using their brains and their capability. So the wealth gap that everybody talks about is really stupid. Do they want to take the wealth away from the people who are smartest about wealth creation and give it to somebody who's the stupidest, i.e. government? It just makes no sense. So with that, that's my little rant. But I think that my happiness really comes as much from my family and the projects that I'm working on. I just love to work on projects, and they give me a lot of happiness to, you know, take something that hasn't existed before and make it happen today.
Wow. So one last question, actually two more questions, and then we'll wrap things up. I'm really curious, kind of, you know, what is your vision of the future of the web, technology, and business all kind of working together? This is just out of personal curiosity.
Well, the thing that's very interesting is that the web as a worldwide connector is fragile, and yet it's robust. You see countries trying to modify the free access of information, and they're universally failing at it. Does that mean that they're going to fail at it forever? Probably not. But or probably, it's one of those scary things. But clearly, the web is changing everything when it comes to geographical boundaries, market friction. Look at Alibaba. It used to be you'd have to get a chain of advisors and agents to find you a appropriate manufacturer in China. Now it's two clicks away for a product. And there's this elimination of friction in everything from pricing to products to things. It's incredible. Of course, one of the biggest things that I think is going to change everything is the autonomous vehicle. And a lot of people think of it as Google, but virtually every car company in the world has an auto drive thing section going on. And there will be auto drive cars on the road within 3 to 4 years. And it will change everything. And so in some ways, the automobile becomes an extension of the web. And so that the web, which is about bits, starts controlling more and more atoms, if you would, in terms of the transportation infrastructure. And that's happening everywhere. Nest and the connectivity of your objects, the Internet of Things, massively changing, where things just become smart. And it will lead to a better lifestyle for us and a lot of very interesting challenges. Amazing. I mean, I don't want people to be able to hack my car or my house, but they probably will.
Yeah. So Nolan, one last question for you, and this is how we close all our interviews here at the Unmistakable Creative. You know, I mean, you've had such an amazing life and witnessed some of the most brilliant people and have done some amazing things yourself. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Well, a lot of times, history is written by the victors. And being unmistakable often happens to people who were part of the shepherds of interesting technologies. Steve gets credit for an awful lot of the work product of some brilliant people, as I do. And so I always like to the quote that Walt Disney had, that when he was asked, what do you do, Mr. Disney? And he said, well, do you draw the pictures? And he said, no. Do you work on the parts? He said, no. And he says, well, I'm more like a honeybee who just sort of takes ideas from one place to another. And so I think sometimes we who have been able to shepherd a group of talented people to some amazing outcomes, we get branded as being remarkable, when in fact we've just been able to be there while all this stuff was happening.
Well, Nolan, let me say, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share some of your insights with our listeners here at Unmistakable Creative. A friend of mine said, trust me, Nolan gives an amazing interview and I can see why now. And this has definitely been one of my favorite chats we've had on the show in 5 years.
Well, thank you very much. And watch for Brain Rush. This is a commercial.
Sure.
Go into brainrush.com. I've got a little educational software company and we're doing some very interesting things with brain science. And you'll be able to learn things faster than ever before. And one of our objectives is to teach kids so quickly that they have no chance to get bored and turned off with education. And so that's kind of my goal.
Amazing. Well, again, I can't thank you enough. This has been just absolutely fascinating. And for those of you guys listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.